Hello everyone, I'm Harry Bucknell. Thank you for downloading this podcast from ABF, the Soldiers' Charity. If boxes were made for thinking in, my guest, Adam Holloway, Member of Parliament for Gravesham since 2005, respected ITN investigative journalist, former captain of the Grenadier Guards and Gulf War veteran, can be guaranteed to be thinking out of them. Few people can claim to have spent their first year after school with the Afghan resistance fighting the Soviet army. To understand a problem, he says, there is no substitute for getting out on the ground. In this month's wide-ranging edition of General Talk, we discuss the work of Parliament in relation to defence, procurement, the lack of experience among the British political classes, the need for long-term vision, and the compelling reasons why global Britain has much to offer on the world stage today. But we began our conversation looking at a picture of the former Libyan dictator, Colonel Gaddafi. I hope you enjoy the programme. We're sat in your office here. You've got a picture of Colonel Gaddafi. What's the story behind
that? So I basically went out to Egypt and drove across the desert and went to Benghazi and went down to the front line at Ashdabir just to sort of see what was going on. And then 6 months later, when Tripoli fell, I went from Tunisia in. And when we arrived, there were still bodies on the streets. Spent the first day looking for water, funnily enough. And within 24 hours, it was extraordinary. All the bodies were gone. The traffic policemen were back in their uniforms. But I was on the second day, I think, I was in the tunnels underneath Gaddafi's sort of big compound. And you know, I wasn't very well prepared. I was using the torch from my mobile phone. And there were sort of bits of flooding and all these sort of rooms with sort of barrack rooms off and communication stuff. Anyway, I can't remember what happened, but we got scared. And so I ran up this sort of spiral staircase and found myself in Gaddafi's private living quarters that were actually relatively modest. So I picked up every piece of paper I could, and including that poster, which I obviously had reframed. And I got a clock. There was this Sawar from Misrata, one of the fighters busy looting the house. There was this really cheap sort of plastic clock. And he said, "Give this to David Cameron from the people of Libya." And so I gave Cameron this clock from the people of Libya.
As a soldier, do you find that you're constantly reminding people what it's like to be in the armed forces?
No, that job is actually done in Parliament very nicely by an MP called James Gray and his assistant Colonel Johnny Longbottom of the HAC, and they run something called the Armed Forces Parliamentary Scheme, which is designed for MPs to have to do 21 days a year, and they basically join the Navy, the Air Force, or the Army, or they go to Staff College, and they learn about the military through that. And you know, if you think about it, our parents, your dad and mine, probably both did national service. Mine certainly did. But the other people who are sitting in this office with us now, who are in their 20s, you know, it was their grandparents who did national service. So you've got much less understanding of the military in society at large, but also in Parliament. So this Armed Forces Parliamentary Scheme, you know, does a remarkable job at making MPs of all parties who might come in quite sceptical of the military to understand them better.
You have been involved in defence, in government, in Parliament, all the way through your time as an MP. Can you just tell us about what you get involved in?
Yes, I've been on the Defence Select Committee for quite a long time. I was on that. And I think I was also chairman of the Conservative Backbench Defence Committee. But what that really did was it gave me the opportunity to go to places where the British military were involved, Iraq, to Afghanistan, and also to Libya. Select committees are supposed to hold government departments to account, but I think with the Defence Select Committee was particularly useful for actually, you know, getting out to these places to see what was going on, because one of the real problems you've got in Parliament now is that people spend most of their time basically being glorified social workers looking after their constituents, and there are no sort of budgets to go off to war zones. So if you want people to actually understand a little bit about what's going on, where we've committed, you know, very substantial blood and treasure, then select committee is a very good way of getting to do that. There's no substitute for actually getting out on the ground.
They have the issue of Ajax.
Well, this is the thing that really struck me, actually, when I was on the defence committee. With equipment, I mean, basically, you know, this expression, the best is the enemy of the good. It's like with, what was the thing before Ajax, the programme for all those armoured vehicles? What was it called? Frez. The Frez programme. So what were they doing? I mean, they were basically thinking, right, what's war going to be like in, you know, 15, 20 years' time, and what equipment are we going to need? And designing it all from scratch. It's a bit like me saying, Harry, I'm coming to your 70th birthday party in 14 years' time or whatever it is. I'm not going to sort of wait until nearer the time to see what outfit I should get. I think I'm going to try and predict what the fashion's going to be and what sort of modern materials I should have my suit made out of. So I think some of the things in defence procurement are completely insane. I remember going up to somewhere in Lancashire with BAE Systems, and there was this hangar full of all these old Nimrod planes that were being refurbished. And these were old Comet airliners from the 1950s. Yes. And I remember this thing, that each plane, I think, it had something like 200 million quid spent on it. A 1950s plane with rivets and holes on the side. And you just take a look at defence procurement, you just think, you know, God, what is happening here? These crazy, expensive decisions. You'll remember when the useless SA-80 rifle came. We designed this sort of bullpup thing from a design that had been rejected in the 1950s. Yeah. Well, we could have just bought the best, you know, rather than designing our own thing and building it. We could have built, you know, Armalite rifles, in Birmingham.
Do you think that having a civilian recruiting organisation running the army's recruiting has helped?
I can only comment from what I've seen with constituents and with one of my godchildren, who, a very, very able individual with a first-class degree in Arabic, now serving in an elite unit, very much elite unit. And this individual almost gave up, because I think it was a phone call Capita, took nearly a year to process them. Now, you know, there's somebody who wouldn't be on an elite squadron at the moment, that very nearly wasn't because of Capita. So I imagine there are some cost savings, but it's not just in, you know, the costs aren't just in process, they're in you know, wasted opportunity. But having said that, you know, I mean, one of the things that really strikes me is the quality of the modern army. I mean, you know, when I first went to my battalion, you know, I could have been a rather more serious soldier, and today I feel these guys, because they've been honed by these forever wars, it has a very different, very much more focused, more technical, professional thing, and that's right throughout the ranks.
You served in the Special Forces, and there is a greater emphasis now on the Special Forces, or a greater accent on that, yet a smaller pool to recruit from. That must add certain other sort of pressures to the army to be able to fulfil these roles.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. And you saw that problem historically, where the naval special forces were recruiting just from the Royal Marines, whereas the army were recruiting from a much, much wider pool. I mean, yes, of course that's an issue. I don't know what the answer is. It certainly is not to drop the quality of the people going in, which at the moment is extremely high, but perhaps one could think more creatively about, you know, how people, the routes people have to getting into the army. And, you know, again, there is definitely a role for bringing on reservists. So, you know, able people who, you know, haven't spent, you know, 5 years in the parachute regiment necessarily. But you're right. I mean, that is a very hard circle to square.
What is your take on the state of British defence today?
Well, we've had a couple of decades where we followed the Americans into these so-called forever wars, and whilst the military have done everything and more that was asked of them, I think that they were really let down by the political class. And in the political class, I'll include some of the very senior officers. I mean, what happened after 9/11? I mean, we had an attack on the US by a very small, crazy, nihilistic group in the form of Al-Qaeda, who were very much on the margins of the Muslim world. I mean, you know, there was a wave of sympathy through the Middle East, in fact, after 9/11 for the United States, for most people. But what happened by our actions after 9/11? You know, the invasion of Iraq, the NATO deployment to Afghanistan, extraordinary rendition, etc., 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 is, I believe, that we actually reinforced the Al-Qaeda narrative that the West wanted to come to Muslim lands, take their natural resources and kill Muslims. So I think defence has been put in a very, very difficult position over the last couple of decades. And I see the reason for these disasters. It's kind of like this, if you can just sort of explain my take on it. I think we had a problem with a very inexperienced political class. I mean, I remember being at a National Security Council meeting where a very, very, very senior person asked me what level of threat the Taliban presented to the streets of Britain's cities. And as you'll be aware, you know, the Taliban have thrown so much as a stone on a street in a British city. They're a completely different beast from Al-Qaeda. So you had an ignorant and inexperienced political class. Then on top of that, you had a foreign office which basically was quite careerist. People were engaged in groupthink. They knew what they had to say to their political masters. I remember after one briefing in Afghanistan from a senior foreign office official, I was there independently a couple of weeks later, and he bounced up to me in the Gandamak bar, and he said, "Adam, I'm so sorry about that briefing I gave a couple of weeks ago. I could see that you thought I was talking bullshit. The problem is, we don't get promoted for telling the truth." So you've got the political class, foreign office, and then the military. I mean, you will remember when we first arrived in Helmand province, the military were, you know, yes, we can. It's this very positive, excellent can-do attitude. But unfortunately, I don't think the senior officers were honest with ministers.
Simon Cam, in his book Change the Guard, he cites this as being very much the case.
Oh, I remember sitting with one of the brigade commanders in Helmand and him telling me how, no, we had plenty of helicopters. And then a few weeks later, you know, lovely Rupert Thornloaf from the Welsh Guards was blown up. Why? Because he was making what he called another unnecessary and dangerous road move. So you had compliant senior officers. And then the fourth element is that we don't seem to listen to the experts anymore. You know, we had plenty of people who were involved with the Stinger missile program in the Panjshir Valley during the Soviet times. Plenty of people who knew the country who were saying, hey, don't do this in Afghanistan, for example. So, as I say, defence has been put into a very difficult position. And I think those four elements have been the drivers of it. But more widely, though, you know, we've got to really up our game technologically. And there was that nasty little war last year between Armenia and Azerbaijan. And the Armenians fielded large numbers of men, lots of old Soviet kit, you know, those Stalin's organs, tanks, you know, you name it. But they were absolutely obliterated by the Azeris, because the Azeris had fabulous surveillance and fabulous long distance strike. And you see these absolutely heartbreaking videos of Armenian soldiers busy digging in, and then wallop, in comes something that literally blows them to bits. They're horrendous videos, actually. And, you know, I don't want British troops in future to get onto a battlefield and us not have dominance in that space, because the future means that, you know, with this extraordinary surveillance capabilities now, the only way you're going to survive on the battlefield is if you do that better. So I very much support the rest of it.
You spent a lot of time out in Afghanistan as a reporter and living with the Mujahideen over the last 35 years or so. How do you think the Taliban will run Afghanistan?
The problem is that there is not really one Taliban, and right now, in fact, you know, you've got reports of some real tension, not just actually amongst the people from non-Pashtun groups, but actually within the there's a split now between the group down in Kandahar, for example. And there was even rumours of a shootout in the presidential palace that I don't think are true. You know, I mean, time will tell. But, you know, we've just done this massive airlift, and if I was an Afghan officer or an intelligence officer or one of our interpreters, I would be desperate to get out with my family. But it doesn't change the fact that those intelligence officers and Afghan special forces and interpreters all went through multiple Taliban checkpoints on the way to the airport. Now, if the Taliban were going to do sort of summary executions, that would have been the perfect opportunity. And they, you know, they didn't. So what's happened is we've taken out most of the corrupt elite who benefited to the tunes of so many hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars through corruption. And we've also taken out a substantial number of the professional, educated middle class, which, you know, the Taliban will not be in power forever. This will be a disaster for Afghanistan. But, you know, I say again, if I'd been one of those people, I would have wanted to go. I wouldn't have risked staying to see how the Taliban will behave. But, you know, I mean, let's see how the Taliban go. I mean, we obviously they were appalling when they were last in power. You know, who knows whether they've learned that lesson. But I mean, I remember on one of my trips to Helmand, and I've probably been, I don't know, I'm prone to exaggeration these days, but I've probably been 20, 25 times in the last 15 years. And I remember once, I wasn't with the military. I was in Helmand province kind of on my own and under my own arrangements via some Afghans. And I was staying in this house in central Lashkargah. I was actually sleeping in the garden, because I was worried if the Taliban came in the night. So I had an oil barrel by the wall of this house I was staying in. I had a silver compass around my neck with the bearing to the British base where this errant MP would run to if things had gone bad. But anyway, I woke up the first morning and there were a couple of little girls playing in the garden. So I said to my host, Engineer Payenda, I said, "Who are these little girls?" And he said, "Oh, they're the daughters of a Taliban commander from Sangin." And I said, "Oh, what, they're here for their safety, are they?" He said, "Oh, no, it's just that the parents are very keen that they should continue their education." So, you know, not all as it says on the pack. And let's remember, you know, even when we were in Helmand, if you and I had a land dispute, we wouldn't go to the government where you'd have to pay money to get justice, i.e. a bribe. You'd walk out to another village, I can't remember which one it was, and you'd meet a Taliban judge who'd give you a just settlement. So I'm in no way an apologist for the Taliban, but I'm just trying to sort of hopefully see that there's a chance of a bright side. But if you look at the people who are in their five-man ruling council, you know, it includes Haqqani himself, who, of course, you know, we know his story. So, you know, let us see. But I think it's absolutely critical that we don't just see our role now as getting out the people who work for us and British passport holders, important as that is. I think it's extremely important, given that there's going to be an economic collapse in that country now, that we do everything we can to get aid in there, you know, without bolstering the Taliban's position, because those poor benighted people, they are going to need it.
What do you think that the lessons that the British military have learned from this withdrawal there?
From the withdrawal? Well, I suppose it just, the biggest screaming headline, I guess, is a requirement for partners. And so, you know, if you lose your biggest partner, you can't conduct operations anymore. But I think the other challenge for Afghanistan now is not just the aid thing, but, you know, you do have this very exclusive, hardline Pashtun Taliban government. And, you know, they by no means are ruling by consent. You know, lots of the existing Taliban hate them, and you know, large swathes of the country do not welcome them at all, although it must be noted that in some parts of the country they are welcome. But in order to get a more inclusive government with different ethnic groups and people who aren't Talibs themselves in, the Taliban aren't going to do that voluntarily. They're going to have to be forced to do it. And I believe that we should be thinking about providing non-lethal support to the resistance, such of it that remains in those few valleys in the Panjshir, but also in every town and village. Because I think that if the Taliban realise that, you know, the country will be contested, then they're much more likely to agree to some sort of roadmap to peace and some sort of government of national unity. You know, let's not forget that it sort of, I don't know when it was, around 2007, 2009, you know, our interlocutors with the Taliban were saying that, you know, the Taliban would take a couple of government ministries and control of lots of districts in the south and the east in return for stopping their war. You know, so we really blew a political opportunity again, because, you know, in the US and here, it was somehow conflated the Taliban with Al Qaeda, and they are completely different things, as we've discussed.
We mentioned the global vision. We come to the new AUKUS pact with the Australia, UK, US.
Well, I mean, this evening I'm going to the Brexit Spartans ERG dinner. We were the 28 who wouldn't vote for Theresa May's deal. And, you know, those of us who are arguing for Brexit and, you know, whose political careers haven't exactly thrived, partly as a result of that, you know, we'd be very sort of, we have a very optimistic vision. I mean, you know, who are we? We are, you know, we are the people who invented the internet. We have the language of the internet. We have the best universities in the world. We have the fifth biggest economy in the world. We have the strategic nuclear deterrent. But the real thing we've got, the real whammy we've got, that people don't take into account, is we have these amazing relationships with all these Commonwealth countries and all the countries of the Anglosphere that, you know, France and Belgium or Luxembourg doesn't, or Poland does not have. So we have a lot of existing friends. We've had, you know, high levels of immigration from our traditional friends. You know, my constituency, about 50% of the people are from India. So we have a great opportunity to be global Britain. And, you know, China is, you know, has a completely different philosophical model to us, and they are getting themselves engaged in countries all around the world. And actually, you know, the Western democracies, or democracies everywhere, you know, we've got to work together to contain that. So I very much welcome doing stuff with our traditional friends, the Australians and the Americans. And look, you know, we've always been in Five Eyes, the intelligence cooperating one, which includes as well Canada and New Zealand. And I go back to my earlier point about this real danger of an inexperienced political class, you know, pliant officials, keen to please military officers and ignoring the experts. And, you know, actually, I think as a country, you know, we need to be better at sort of, you know, long-term vision of where we want to go, and we really need to nurture expertise. In fact, I said this to the head of the Foreign Office at a committee meeting once, that the Foreign Office, you know, no longer had great experts in the countries to which we sent ambassadors, and, you know, the language school had all gone, and all of this stuff, which I believe to be true. But a couple of weeks later, I had this charming letter from the British ambassador to Tokyo. He said, you know, dear Adam, you know, I've read the transcript and your comments about the Foreign Office, our lack of knowing about the cultures and the language. I hope you'll forgive me when I enclose my book of Japanese poetry in Japanese.
Adam Holloway, thank you so much for being my guest this afternoon on General Talk.
I'm most honoured.
And my thanks once again to Adam Holloway for being my guest on the programme. As the festive season begins, I ask you not to forget the plight of the homeless, many of whom are former service personnel paying the price of defending democracy and guaranteeing our security, so we at home can sleep safe in our beds at night. To understand the work we at ABF, the Soldiers' Charity, the British Army's national charity, carry out for the welfare of our soldiers, past and present, and their immediate families to avoid hardship and enjoy the independence and dignity they deserve, please visit soldierscharity.org to read just some of the stories of those we have helped. Last year alone, we supported over 60,000 people
in 63 different countries around the world, equivalent to the entire population of the city of Hereford. General Talk, back in the new year, with Academy Sergeant Major Colin Kirkwood, Scott Scars, talking about life as Sergeant Major of the Royal Military Academy at Sandhurst. Until then, it's farewell from me, Harry Bucknell, and on behalf of everyone at the Soldiers' Charity, I wish you all a very happy, peaceful and safe Christmas. Thank you for listening. With editing by Michael Stiglianu, this podcast has been a Gamekeeper production for ABF, the Soldiers' Charity.